Chapter 3. The man from somewhere, Mr. and Mrs. Veneering were brand new people in a brand new house in a brand new quarter of London. Everything about the Veneerings was spick and span new. All their furniture was new, all their friends were new, all their servants were new, their plate was new, their carriage was new, their harness was new, their horses were new, their pictures were new, they themselves were new, they were as newly married as was lawfully compatible with their having a brand new baby, and if they had set up a great-grandfather, he would have come home in matting from the Pantechnicon, without a scratch upon him, French polish to the crown of his head. For, in the Veneering establishment, from the hall chairs with the new coat of arms, to the grand pianoforte with the new action, and upstairs again to the new fire escape, all things were in a state of high varnish and polish. And what was observable in the furniture, was observable in the Veneerings. The surface smelt a little too much of the workshop, and was a trifle sticky. There was an innocent piece of dinner furniture that went upon easy casters and was kept over a livery stable yard in Duke Street, St. James, when not in use, to whom the Veneerings were a source of blind confusion. The name of this article was Twemlow. Being first cousin to Lord Snigsworth, he was in frequent requisition, and at many houses might be said to represent the dining table in its normal state. Mr. and Mrs. Veneering, for example, arranging a dinner, habitually started with Twemlow, and then put leaves in him, or added guests to him. Sometimes, the table consisted of Twemlow and half a dozen leaves, sometimes, of Twemlow and a dozen leaves, sometimes, Twemlow was pulled out to his utmost extent of 20 leaves. Mr. and Mrs. Veneering on occasions of ceremony faced each other in the center of the board, and thus the parallel still held, for, it always happened, that the more Twemlow was pulled out, the further he found himself from the center, and nearer to the sideboard at one end of the room, or the window curtains at the other. But, it was not this which steeped the feeble soul of Twemlow in confusion. This he was used to, and could take soundings of. The abyss to which he could find no bottom, and from which started forth the engrossing, and ever-swelling difficulty of his life, was the insoluble question whether he was Veneering's oldest friend, or newest friend. To the excogitation of this problem, the harmless gentleman had devoted many anxious hours, both in his lodgings over the livery stable yard, and in the cold gloom, favorable to meditation, of St. James Square. Thus, Twemlow had first known Veneering at his club, where Veneering then knew nobody but the man who made them known to one another, who seemed to be the most intimate friend he had in the world, and whom he had known 2 days. The bond of union between their souls, the nefarious conduct of the committee respecting the cookery of a fillet of veal, having been accidentally cemented at that date. Immediately upon this, Twemlow received an invitation to dine with Veneering, and dined, the man being of the party. Immediately upon that, Twemlow received an invitation to dine with the man, and dined, Veneering being of the party. At the man's were a member, an engineer, a payer off of the national debt, a poem on Shakespeare, a grievance, and a public office, who all seemed to be utter strangers to Veneering. And yet immediately after that, Twemlow received an invitation to dine at Veneering's, expressly to meet the member, the engineer, the payer off of the national debt, the poem on Shakespeare, the grievance, and the public office, and, dining, discovered that all of them were the most intimate friends Veneering had in the world, and that the wives of all of them who were all there were the objects of Mrs. Veneering's most devoted affection and tender confidence. Thus it had come about that Mr. Twemlow had said to himself in his lodgings, with his hand to his forehead, "I must not think of this. This is enough to soften any man's brain," apostrophe, and yet was always thinking of it, and could never form a conclusion. This evening the Veneerings give a banquet. 11 leaves in the Twemlow, 14 in company all told. Four pigeon-breasted retainers in plain clothes stand in line in the hall. A fifth retainer, proceeding up the staircase with a mournful air as who should say, "Here is another wretched creature come to dinner, such is life." ... announces, "Mr. Twemlow." Mrs. Veneering welcomes her sweet Mr. Twemlow. Mr. Veneering welcomes his dear Twemlow. Mrs. Veneering does not expect that Mr. Twemlow can in nature care much for such insipid things as babies, but so old a friend must please to look at baby. "Ah, you will know the friend of your family better, Tootliums," says Mr. Veneering, nodding emotionally at that new article, "when you begin to take notice." He then begs to make his dear Twemlow known to his two friends, Mr. Boots and Mr. Brewer, and clearly has no distinct idea which is which. But now a fearful circumstance occurs. Mr. and Mrs. Podsnap. "My dear," says Mr. Veneering to Mrs. Veneering, with an air of much friendly interest, while the door stands open, "the Podsnaps." Two smiling large men, with a fatal freshness on him, appearing with his wife, instantly deserts his wife and darts at Twemlow with, "How do you do? So glad to know you. Charming house you have here. I hope we are not late. So glad of the opportunity, I am sure." When the first shock fell upon him, Twemlow twice skipped back in his neat little shoes, and his neat little silk stockings of a bygone fashion, as if impelled to leap over a sofa behind him, but the large man closed with him, and proved too strong. "Let me," says the large man, trying to attract the attention of his wife in the distance, "have the pleasure of presenting Mrs. Podsnap to her host. She will be," in his fatal freshness he seems to find perpetual verdure and eternal youth in the phrase, "she will be so glad of the opportunity, I am sure." In the meantime, Mrs. Podsnap, unable to originate a mistake on her own account, because Mrs. Veneering is the only other lady there, does her best in the way of handsomely supporting her husband's, by looking towards Mr. Twemlow with a plaintive countenance and remarking to Mrs. Veneering in a feeling manner, firstly, that she fears he has been rather bilious of late, and, secondly, that the baby is already very like him. It is questionable whether any man quite relishes being mistaken for any other man. But, Mr. Veneering having this very evening set up the shirt front of the young anti-nouse in Newark cambric just come home, is not at all complimented by being supposed to be Twemlow, who is dry, and weazen and some 30 years older. Mrs. Veneering equally resents the imputation of being the wife of Twemlow. As to Twemlow, he is so sensible of being a much better bred man than Veneering, that he considers the large man an offensive ass. In this complicated dilemma, Mr. Veneering approaches the large man with extended hand, and smilingly assures that incorrigible personage that he is delighted to see him, who in his fatal freshness instantly replies, "Thank you. I am ashamed to say that I cannot at this moment recall where we met, but I am so glad of this opportunity, I am sure." Then pouncing upon Twemlow, who holds back with all his feeble might, he is hailing him off to present him, as Veneering, to Mrs. Podsnap, when the arrival of more guests unravels the mistake. Whereupon, having reshaken hands with Veneering as Veneering, he reshakes hands with Twemlow as Twemlow, and winds it all up to his own perfect satisfaction, by saying to the last named, "Ridiculous opportunity, but so glad of it, I am sure." Now, Twemlow having undergone this terrific experience, having likewise noted the fusion of Boots in Brewer and Brewer in Boots, and having further observed that of the remaining 7 guests 4 discreet characters enter with wandering eyes, and wholly decline to commit themselves, as to which is Veneering, until Veneering has them in his grasp, Twemlow, having profited by these studies, finds his brain wholesomely hardening as he approaches the conclusion that he really is Veneering's oldest friend. When his brain softens again, and all is lost, through his eyes encountering Veneering and the large man linked together as twin brothers in the back drawing room near the conservatory door, and through his ears informing him in the tones of Mrs. Veneering that the same large man is to be baby's godfather. Dinner is on the table. Does the melancholy retainer, as who should say, come down and be poisoned, ye unhappy children of men. Twemlow, having no lady assigned him, goes down in the rear, with his hand to his forehead. Boots and Brewer, thinking him indisposed, whisper, man faint. Had no lunch. But he is only stunned by the unvanquishable difficulty of his existence. Revived by soup, Twemlow discourses mildly of the court circular with Boots and Brewer. Is appealed to, at the fish stage of the banquet, by Veneering, on the disputed question whether his cousin Lord Snigsworth is in, or out of town. Gives it that his cousin is out of town. At Snigsworthy Park? Veneering inquires. At Snigsworthy, Twemlow rejoins. Boots and Brewer regard this as a man to be cultivated, and Veneering is clear that he is a remunerative article. Meantime the retainer goes round, like a gloomy analytical chemist, always seeming to say, after Chablis, sir? You wouldn't, if you knew what it's made of. The great-looking glass above the sideboard reflects the table and the company. Reflects the new Veneering crest, in gold and deacon silver, frosted and also thawed, a camel of all work. The Herald's College found out a crusading ancestor for Veneering who bore a camel on his shield, or might have done it, if he had thought of it, and a caravan of camels take charge of the fruits and flowers and candles, and kneel down be loaded with the salt. Reflects Veneering, 40, wavy-haired, dark, tending to corpulence, sly, mysterious, filmy, a kind of sufficiently well-looking veiled prophet, not prophesying. Reflects Mrs. Veneering, fair, aquiline-nosed and fingered, not so much light hair as she might have, gorgeous in raiment and jewels, enthusiastic, propitiatory, conscious that a corner of her husband's veil is over herself. Reflects Podsnap, prosperously feeding, two little light-colored wiry wings, one on either side of his else bald head, looking as like his hairbrushes as his hair, dissolving view of red beads on his forehead, large allowance of crumpled shirt collar up behind. Reflects Mrs. Podsnap, fine woman for Professor Owen, quantity of bone, neck and nostrils like a rocking horse, hard features, majestic headdress in which Podsnap has hung golden offerings. Reflects Twemlow, gray, dry, polite, susceptible to east wind, first gentleman in Europe, collar and cravat, cheeks drawn in, as if he had made a great effort to retire into himself some years ago, and had got so far, and had never got any farther. Reflects mature young lady, raven locks, and complexion that lights up well, when well powdered as it is carrying on considerably in the captivation of mature young gentlemen, with too much nose in his face, too much ginger in his whiskers, too much torso in his waistcoat, too much sparkle in his studs, his eyes, his buttons, his talk, and his teeth. Reflects charming old lady Tippins on Veneering's right, with an immense obtuse drab oblong face, like a face in a tablespoon, and a dyed long walk up the top of her head, as a convenient public approach to the bunch of false hair behind, pleased to patronize Mrs. Veneering opposite, who is pleased to be patronized. Reflects a certain Mortimer, another of Veneering's oldest friends, who never was in the house before, and appears not to want to come again, who sits disconsolate on Mrs. Veneering's left, and who was inveigled by Lady Tippins, a friend of his boyhood, to come to these people's and talk, and who won't talk. reflects Eugene, friend of Mortimer, buried alive in the back of his chair, behind a shoulder with a powder epaulette on it of the mature young lady, and gloomily resorting to the champagne chalice, whenever proffered by the analytical chemist. Lastly, the looking glass reflects Boots and Brewer, and two other stuffed buffers interposed between the rest of the company and possible accidents. The Veneering dinners are excellent dinners or new people wouldn't come, and all goes well. Notably, Lady Tippins has made a series of experiments on her digestive functions, so extremely complicated and daring, that if they could be published with their results it might benefit the human race. Having taken in provisions from all parts of the world, this hardy old cruiser has last touched at the North Pole, when, as the ice plates are being removed, the following words fall from her. I assure you, my dear Veneering apostrophe, poor Twemlow's hand approaches his forehead, for it would seem now that Lady Tippins is going to be the oldest friend. I assure you, my dear Veneering, that it is the oddest affair. Like the advertising people, I don't ask you to trust me without offering a respectable reference. Mortimer there is my reference, and knows all about it. Apostrophe, Mortimer raises his drooping eyelids, and slightly opens his mouth. But a faint smile, expressive of what's the use, apostrophe passes over his face, and he drops his eyelids and shuts his mouth. Now, Mortimer, apostrophe says Lady Tippins, wrapping the sticks of her closed green fan upon the knuckles of her left hand which is particularly rich in knuckles, I insist upon your telling all that is to be told about the man from Jamaica. Apostrophe, give you my honor I never heard of any man from Jamaica, except the man who was a brother, apostrophe replies Mortimer. Tobago, then. Apostrophe, nor yet from Tobago. Apostrophe, except, apostrophe Eugene strikes in. So unexpectedly that the mature young lady, who has forgotten all about him, with a start takes the epaulette out of his way. Except our friend who long lived on rice pudding and a singlet, till at length to his something or other, his physician said something else, and a leg of mutton somehow ended a dago. Apostrophe, a reviving impression goes round the table, that Eugene is coming out. An unfulfilled impression, for he goes in again. Now, my dear Mrs. Veneering, apostrophe quoth Lady Tippins, I appeal to you, whether this is not the basest conduct ever known in this world? I carry my lovers about, two or three at a time, on condition that they are very obedient and devoted. And here is my oldest lover-in-chief, the head of all my slaves, throwing off his allegiance before company. And here is another of my lovers, a rough Simon at present certainly, but of whom I had most hopeful expectations, as to his turning out well in course of time, pretending that he can't remember his nursery rhymes, on purpose to annoy me, for he knows how I dote upon them. Apostrophe apostrophe, a grisly little fiction concerning her lovers is Lady Tippin's point. She is always attended by a lover or two, and she keeps a little list of her lovers, and she is always booking a new lover, or striking out an old lover, or putting a lover in her black list, or promoting a lover to her blue list, or adding up her lovers, or otherwise posting her book. Mrs. Veneering is charmed by the humor, and so is Veneering. Perhaps it is enhanced by a certain yellow play in Lady Tippin's throat, like the legs of scratching poultry. I banish the false wretch from this moment, and I strike him out of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.